Thank you all for coming. Everyone, thank you all for coming. For quieting down. I'm Ken Major. I'm going to be your moderator today. I just want to start by thanking the Harry H. Barron Trust and Rabbi Zev Barron for their continuous support of Torah for Tycoons. Throughout the past 11 seasons, the Kol has brought forth perspectives to businesses and personal ethics to well over 500 people through this program. As we continue our 12th season, the Kol, after surveying numerous participants, has made some significant changes to the program. We look forward to an enhanced experience as the classes as we move forward and welcome your feedback as always. If you take a moment, if you look at the back of the page of your booklets, you'll see that the Torah for Tycoon classes for the next 2 months are already set up. Please let your friends, colleagues, acquaintances know about this great class, especially if there's a topic that you'd like to appeal or you'd like to hear about. Please reach out to the Kollel, and they'll be happy to consider all kinds of topics. The next session will take place in 3 weeks on Wednesday, November 4th. The class will focus on the issues of capital punishment. It will be presented by Rick Kornfeld and Rabbi Aaron Yehuda Schwab. I'd also like to take your attention and point to the Executive Learning Program. There are flyers on the table as well. These programs provide business people and professionals with the opportunity to bring Torah study to their office during the day. And if you'd like to set that up, we're happy to work with you on that as well. And a lot of successful programs doing that in many offices throughout the Denver area. The Denver's Kollel winter semester has begun today, and our programs and learning opportunities will be back in full swing. If you have an interest in starting a learning, even on the phone with partners in Torah or through the executive program in your office or even one-on-one classes with a chavrusa, that is what the Kollel is here for. Please just reach out. Don't be shy. And reach out to one of the guys that are here. Lastly, I'd like to call your attention to the Kollel's MB Glassman Foundation Gold Division, which is dedicated to enhancing the lives of our seniors through Torah programming. A number of programs are already in place, including free weekly lunch and learn here at the deli, as well as a call-in senior program that puts volunteers directly in touch with the seniors in the community. Appreciate the weekly phone calls to schmooze and to develop that meaningful and lasting friendships. For more information, please sign up to any of these programs. See Joyce Litzman, she's sitting over there. She's the one that keeps everyone in line, and she'd be happy to help you. We also, if you've missed any classes in the classes in the past, they're all online at the Kollel's website, denverkollel.org, and you can get on there and see all the classes recorded in the past and download them. Today, we're very excited. We've got a very exciting class, and our presenters today is Adam Moskowitz. He's an agent for State Farm, and Rabbi Mordechai Flesher, senior educator at the Denver Kollel Community. Community Kollel. So we're going to start off with Adam, and he will go ahead and speak for about 10 minutes, and then we will continue from there.
All right. Thank you so much, and thanks Rabbi Flesher and the Denver Community Kollel for having me here today. And thank all of you. I was not expecting this many people for an insurance discussion, so your bravery is to be commended. We're gonna talk about a couple of things, and before we do, before we get into some of the cases, there can be both criminal as well as civil aspects to insurance fraud. Just some statistics to start. The National Insurance Crime Bureau estimates that in property and casualty claims, mainly auto and homeowner claims, somewhere between 10 and 30% of those claims have some element of fraud associated with them. And in a recent survey by the Bureau, they found that 25% of Americans thought that defrauding an insurance company was okay. Mainly, we have all the money and everyone else is doing it, so I'm gonna get mine too, or among the top reasons folks thought that was okay. And in Colorado specifically, just last year, this aspects of insurance fraud have fallen generally just under the the fraud laws in Colorado, but the legislature enacted a specific insurance fraud statute last year with both civil and criminal penalties for folks and as well as companies who engage in it. And what we wanted to talk about is some of the cases that are a little more unusual, things that really lead one down the slippery slope to fraud, not just, can I burn my own house down and get the money? Okay, the answer is no. And I'm sure the rabbi would agree with that one. But there's some other things that go on in my business on a, quite frankly, a daily basis that get a little bit more complicated. And fraud can occur anywhere from the initial application stage of getting a policy going all the way, and most commonly probably to the claim stage. So I wanted to start by first bringing up some things in the application phase. So Mr. Majors and I were talking about something just a few minutes ago about teenage drivers. So, for example, those that have them know that teenage drivers might be more expensive to insure than folks who are not teenage drivers. And so it might happen that someone calls in to get some insurance, and in discussing the drivers in their car, they just don't mention that they have teenage drivers. One of the reasons teenage drivers are so expensive to insure is because they cause a lot of accidents, and so that's when we find out that teenage driver's in your household. And so when someone withholds that information, there's a couple of things that the insurance company can do. First, they are entitled to the premium that they should have been charging for that policy from the time that the person was in the household and driving. As a general rule, I haven't seen us or any other company go back and charge that premium. But what does normally happen is from that day forward, the company's going to go ahead and charge for that young driver. And again, for those of you that have them, they're expensive. And when you have a teenage driver that just caused an accident, anyway, I want to be your insurance agent because that's a great client for me. The other things that can happen in the application process get a little more complicated. For example, if someone's applying for life insurance and they, in their mind and to their understanding, they're perfectly healthy, well, once you start that process, the company itself is going to do its own underwriting through asking you some questions and having a paramed take a look at you. But if during that process the client himself, the person who's filled out the application, comes to find out that they do have some kind of issue, their doctor tells them they have diabetes, they have cancer, something has come up that doesn't show up through the life insurance examination, and before that policy is issued, the question comes, what kind of duty, if any, does somebody have to report that to the company? And in fact, the policies, pretty much all insurance policies, have clauses in the application that say that if you have any information that is material to the issuance or rating of that policy, then you are expected and required to give that information. And when we talk about material information, we're talking about information that a reasonable company is going to use to decide, first, whether to issue that policy, and second, what kind of rate if they do issue it. And in these situations, again, luckily this one I haven't encountered myself, but when they do come up, there's a number of different remedies that can happen. First, any insurance policy is just a contract. And so if you have information that the company needs to make a decision and you don't give that information, the company can simply say there wasn't a meeting of the minds, this isn't a valid contract, and rescind it. Simply say the contract is void, send you back the premiums that you've paid, and in that case not send any death benefit on the policy. Other things that can happen, again, in certain situations they can charge back premium if they would have issued the policy, but at a higher rate. And obviously if it's a life insurance policy and it's a claim, they're not going to charge any future premiums, so that one's off the table. But they can go ahead, as I said, and just rescind the policy and just say this was never a contract to begin with. Certain other things that come up that are much more common happen in the claims process. And just as an example, if someone gets in a car accident and part of their car gets damaged, and that part of the car or one close to it had prior damage, for example. The question comes up then, of course, do I have to tell the insurance company about that, and if not, what happens? If, just as an example, if the hood of a car is damaged and then you get in a car wreck and the hood is completely needs to be replaced because of the second car accident, the company still wants you to tell them about it, but in either case, they're just going to go ahead and replace the roof, the hood. But in other cases where there's some kind of damage to that part of the car and it gets hit and gets further damage, then you're running into a grayer area. Because the company, of course, can look to someone to file two separate claims and have two deductibles that they wouldn't then have to pay. If it's a case, though, where someone, just to tell you what happens in practicality, if it's a case where someone just doesn't mention anything and the company sends out an adjuster, that adjuster looks at the car and doesn't find that prior damage, the company just, it's bad on them and they take care of it all. And I have never seen a case where they go back to look for the funds from that person. There are cases, though, where people try to intentionally cover up that damage, whether if it's an old dent that had some paint missing and so it got rusty so you could tell it was an old dent or something like that, and they paint over it, then it gets to be much more problematic. And the company, in those situations, can go back and look for funds to be paid from you to fix that, or at least for a deductible to be refunded, some things like that. But in those cases, they're still going to take care of whatever damage was actually there. And then the last two things I want to bring up briefly are two things that these are really these happen on a pretty frequent basis. And the first is in a homeowner's claim. If whether it's a fire, which luckily these days is pretty rare, or much more likely a burglary situation where someone's gone into someone's house and taken a lot of things, the issue comes up about what exactly was taken. And it comes up because, quite frankly, nowadays we all have so much stuff. You know, if someone came into my house and took away 30, 40% of my belongings, okay, I'd write them a thank you note, and then for the insurance company, I'd have to list what there is, and I don't know. And so the question becomes, what do you even do there? And so normally people make categories and say clothing, $30,000, or however much clothing happens to be. That's totally normal. And the company, as a general rule, expects those kinds of things. It doesn't expect you to know every single thing you own. When it comes to bigger ticket items or special items, they're certainly going to expect to see some kind of documentation or at least a picture of it somewhere. You know, you the kid standing in front of the TV or something. For those of you that have TVs. So that's fine. But it does get to be problematic when it gets to be more of an intentional thing. So, for example, someone says, well, in this list they stole two sets of Ping golf clubs. And you've never been golfing, you've never owned a pair of clubs. Those are things that, I mean, obviously it's a problem. But it gets to be very problematic. Our company, I haven't seen us or really heard of people resorting to this, but when there are cases of just intentional fraud in terms of a claim like that, intentionally inflating it with items that just don't exist, one of the remedies the company has actually is they can just deny the entire claim. Again, I've never seen that actually happen, but it's one of the remedies that's available to them now. And then the last thing I'm going to touch on briefly is more fraud that deals with the actual agent's office. And one of the things that happens is clients will call and give us a scenario and kind of ask for advice. And with me and my staff, there are times it gets very tricky, because here's the thing. There's the company that writes all the big checks to people, and then there's the agent's office that when one of their clients has some kind of claim, We want money to just gush all over that person and the person to be very happy and to skip out of there saying this is, you know, a terrible thing happened and they made it a wonderful experience. And I'm sure those of you that have had claims felt exactly that way every time. So that's the dichotomy, and that's kind of where we're stuck in the agent's office. And so, for example, if someone calls in and says, I was driving through the parking lot and I bumped the light pole and it dented my car. Well, insurance is going to pay for that. But one of the things that can happen from that is, it was their fault. They were driving a car. It was only them, but they still caused damage to their own car. And so the company can look at that as an at-fault accident and raise their rates because of that. And so in the discussions with people, an agent has an opportunity there, to kind of help massage the facts. And so people say things like, well, you know, before we file this, let me just make sure I understand what happened. You know, if a person is driving through a parking lot and hits a pole, that's an at-fault accident, and that can have a negative impact on your rates. But if when you came out of King Soopers you found that someone had hit your car and didn't leave a note, that's a different issue. And in that case, nothing will happen to your rates because that was not an at-fault accident and we'll still pay it just the same. And you can think of lots of other scenarios like that that we have to deal with the majority of the phone calls we take in a claim situation. As you can imagine, in that case, the company's not going to take a dim view of the client, but rather of the agent himself, and then we'll see what would happen with that person in those situations.
What happens?
In our company, when those things happen, people will find that they will have to take an ethics course at times. If it's a minor thing, there are times when it's much more major, and they find that they're out on the street looking for a different job, for example.
Most companies will have a fraud unit.
Yes.
The larger companies, that if they suspect in a claim situation, if they suspect something, they'll get the fraud unit involved, and that can be quite annoying.
Yeah. No. And thank you for bringing that up. And that's the other thing. Just when there is a case where they suspect fraud, and those folks do get involved. You know, they do try to be thorough, and they're trying to make sure whether or not fraud is going on, exactly like you say. And if there's not, they'll happily pay the claim. But getting to that point can feel, whether you're the agent who's being investigated, which sometimes happens, or the claimant, it can feel like you're going through a tax audit at times. They can get pretty darn detailed. So that's my part.
Excellent. So now
no questions. No other
anything else. Oh, and so did anyone want to ask questions about that before we go on?
I went to the insurance company. It was the other person's policy. And so they have certain companies that do the repairs. They didn't have an adjuster came to look at it, but the decision was made by the shop that I went to. And I had some prior damage where it was. But basically, I told them this thing for here before, but they made the decision whether to report it. I didn't think, but basically, the body shop, and I don't know if it made a difference in what the cost of it was, but I mean, are we responsible for what these body shops do when they recommend them and they don't have an adjuster or anybody watching?
Yeah, so that's great. Thank you. So if from the insurance company's point of view, if the shop has been authorized by the insurance company to take care of these things without an adjuster seeing it, and you tell the shop that there was some prior damage, you have discharged your duty as far as the insurance company is concerned.
And I just want to make a comment. You repeatedly have said they'll happily pay to play. Is that only true in states where marijuana is legal? My experience, you know, is they pay to play, but I never got a smile or a kiss.
Okay, well, and they're not going to skip over to your house to write the check. You're exactly right. But they will, how about, I'll just say they will pay the claim.
Happy is a relative term, too.
All right, so now we're going to have Rabbi Fleischman here give us the Torah's perspective on this whole issue.
Okay, thank you very much, Ken. Thank you very much, Adam. This is as I pointed out to Rabbi Schwab and to Adam before we started this class, this is a bit of a deviation from our standard format in that there are like a bunch of different issues kind of flying around. It's not one unified discussion. There are a number of issues, and what I'd like to try to do is to discuss a few different ideas that are come up in Torah law and Talmudic law, and then see how those ideas apply to the cases, and then people have questions, we'll see what direction those issues go in. So right off the bat, before we even start talking about the different issues of fraud and the application process and the claims process from the agent side, from the client side, the first question I'd like to deal with briefly, and really this is a very broad discussion, but it's very briefly, is what does the Torah say about purchasing insurance in the first place? Okay, I think obviously everyone can surmise that it's permitted, probably advisable from a logical standpoint to buy insurance, and probably you can imagine that if you go ask your rabbi, he'd probably advise you to, I'm not talking about buying insurance on that lawnmower you purchased at Walmart last week, but you know, medical insurance, life insurance, things like that. But interestingly enough, there is just an interesting viewpoint, and the question becomes, if you look at source number one, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, among others, talks about the question, and that is, he says, regarding the matter of whether there is any virtue or perhaps any concern of a prohibition to purchase an insurance policy, he's talking about life insurance right now, due to the fact that one, God forbid, appears to be lacking trust in God and his ability to enrich him, God's ability to enrich a person, so that he leaves after him a large sum for his heirs. So he's kind of raising the question and saying, look, we have to trust in God. You're right, I have to go out and earn a livelihood, but once I've done my time and I have a 9-to-5 job and so on, and I bring home whatever I bring home, so that's it. And the rest is God's problem. God tells Adam, not this Adam, Adam in the Garden of Eden, that because you, he tells all of us also, that because you were not up to your best behavior, you're going to have to sweat it out to make a living. But once I've sweated out to make a living, the rest is on God's tab. So why would one then want to go purchase insurance, life insurance or anything else? It's not my problem. So Rabbi Feinstein says that is not the case. He says, to me there is no lack of trust in God, for this is like all other business matters. Not only is it permitted, but one is obligated to engage in business and labor to earn a livelihood, and it is forbidden for one to say that even if he does nothing, God will provide his livelihood in some way. Right? I can't go home, sit on my couch, be it study Torah or watch football games, depending on your interests, for the rest of my life. Torah is always preferable if you're going to stay home. But you can't do that. You have an obligation, you have a responsibility to provide for your family, to take care of various obligations. You have an obligation to earn a livelihood. Part of that obligation is seeing what could come up in terms of medical issues, in terms of auto insurance issues, home insurance, life insurance, and these kinds of things, as the rabbis say in Pirkei Avos, in Ethics of the Fathers, who is wise? One who sees what is going to occur in the future. You know, you gotta have your eyes open and see what can occur. Just to bury your head in the sand and say everything will be okay is not an approach. I once heard an individual say, why do you have to buy life insurance? If I pass away, the community will take care of my family. That is not that is not, according to many rabbis, that is not an appropriate approach. That's irresponsible to assume that the community will pick up the tab if, God forbid, an individual passes away, leaving a family behind. Part of one's obligation of a livelihood is taking out the insurance policies that will cover for different kinds of disasters. Now, did that mean I have to take out insurance, like I said, on my lawnmower that I purchased from Walmart? No, and I'm sure Adam could talk about whether those are worthwhile or not. But what did you tell me? It's not. Okay, he's not selling those today. but certainly the standard types of insurance policies are, he says, permitted and even obligatory. Not today's discussion, but there is a very broad discussion amongst the authorities in terms of, from a Torah standpoint, how are those policies binding in terms of the laws of acquisitions and contracts and so on. What legal status do they have? That's not our discussion today. If perhaps someone knows someone who has an interest in presenting them, maybe we could do that in the future. But that's not our discussion today. What I would like to discuss, having given that, I guess, lengthy introduction, are the different issues that come up practically in terms of insurance fraud and the application process and the claims process. So let's look at a few ideas over here and then see how they apply to the cases that Adam brought up. Source number two right here is a passage in the Talmud, and Shmuel said, it is forbidden to steal the minds of people. Steal the minds of people is what's called in Hebrew genevas das. Genevas das is not limited to financial areas. On the contrary, it applies to any type of situation where you are deliberately going ahead and fooling someone. The classic case the Talmud talks about is where you are, let's just say,
burning matter.
Huh? That's a lot worse than genevas das. I'm sorry. That's just not stealing people's minds. That's outright theft. He fooled everyone. But let me talk about a simple case. The Talmud talks about a case where you have a guest at your house and you ran out of wine, and so you open a new keg of wine and you say, honored guest, I'm opening this keg of wine in your honor. No, you're not. You were going to open it either way. And so by you saying that and you making him think that you're opening it in his honor, because of him, there's no theft, not costing him anything. On the contrary, he feels very honored and very important. But you're lying through your teeth. You were opening that barrel either way. You're not opening a new bottle, barrel of wine for him specifically. But by you telling him, I'm doing this for you, and he thinks that you're doing this on his behalf, and you're not, that is forbidden. You're not allowed to do that because you're fooling him. Okay? And really, this encompasses a lot of cases. Practically speaking, for our discussion, this becomes an issue, and we'll try to expand on it in a few minutes, if you are withholding information on an application where they think you're being upfront. So before we even get involved in the issue of theft, of playing with the prices on premiums and so on, if you're withholding information and you're signing on the bottom and saying, to the best of my knowledge, all the information contained herein is true, yada, 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 and it's not, you are essentially fooling them before we even get involved in whether you're stealing or not. That's the first issue we have to deal with. And that really you can see in source 3 is it is forbidden to trick people in matters of buying and selling or to steal their minds. Now, the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, adds another layer over here. And he says, for example, if the item for sale has a defect, the seller, must inform the buyer. So if I'm the item for sale, I'm taking out an insurance policy on myself for medical purposes, for life insurance, my car, and so on. If there's an issue and there's a contract going on and there's something there which makes a difference, not informing the other party would be a problem potentially of stealing their mind. And so withholding pertinent information would become problematic in that respect. Even if you look at source number 4, the Sma, who's one of the commentators, Rabbi Yeshua Falk, one of the commentators on the Shulchan Aruch, points out, even though there's no overcharging on the value, there's a defect. The defect does not affect the value on the item. The item is worth the same amount. But there's a defect. Nonetheless, he should have informed him, and it is similar to stealing the mine, which is forbidden even though, as mentioned earlier, there is no loss of money. So, this again, as I said, is an issue regardless of whether it changes the price of the premium or not. If they're asking you for information, and even if you know it's not going to change the price of the premium, or they'll just overlook it and they won't care that much, but the fact that you are misleading the insurance company, or vice versa, I suppose, the insurance company's playing games with the client and saying, oh, this really wasn't damaged, and that, and they know good and well that it was, besides the issues of theft, you have right off the bat an issue of fooling people, of stealing another person's mind by withholding that information. Okay? Bernie Madoff, if you're absolutely correct, was guilty of that, but like I said, he took people's money, and spent it illegally, so that's outright theft.
But he fooled them.
Yeah, he did that also.
Okay.
Yeah, but I'm just saying in the scale of 1 to 10, why he's sitting in jail, that's probably like at the lower end of the issues.
You're using fooled versus lying. Is there a reason that you're...
No, either way. Fool, I mean...
Well, lying includes other things.
Lying, okay.
Very specific,
that is true. Yes, correct. There's.
I come in and tell you a lie.
There's no defect, so that's an omission.
It is a lie.
Is that a lie?
Right.
Lying is if I tell you that ketchup is mustard. That's really not a lie because you know that.
Okay. No, but you are correct. In other words, if I ask my kid, "Did you take a cookie from the cookie jar?" and they say no, with a big smile as the chocolate chip smile through their teeth, so it's that would be lying, potentially Geneva's das as well. They're trying to convince me that it's not true. So you have both issues. But if it's just a statement of fact where they're not really stealing my mind, okay, Rabbi Schwab's case. That's not fooling. So I use the term fooling in that it's a means of leading you to believe something which is relevant to your relationship with me and so on and so forth. That's an issue of stealing one's mind.
I get that. My point is you're talking about the keg of wine.
Right.
That's an out-and-out lie.
Yeah, it is.
Okay.
It's a lie as well. But it wouldn't be categorized per se as theft, as we call Geneva's das. Yeah, it's a form of theft. And according to a lot of authorities, it's under the category of the prohibition of thou shalt not steal.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there's the whole idea of salesmanship, which goes through all products that are sold and bought and sold on the marketplace. The seller will always emphasize the positive aspects of it and play down the negative or what could go wrong. And that's normal salesmanship. We see every day in every product we buy, almost. You go to a used car lot, the guy's going to tell you all the wonderful things about the car. He will not tell you. But there was a recall 10 years ago. There's a responsibility of the buyer here to be aware as best they can. But there's no doubt that this salesmanship has a certain fooling of people in all of our transactions. This is scary.
Mr. Schwab, you want to take that?
No, I just want to say...
Yeah, he has a good story. Yes.
I just want to say our first talk with Tycoons 12 years ago was on this topic, and I think it's time for a rerun.
I want to say that I don't think I'll... likely disagree that this is how it is. The experiences growing up and living in a place like Lakewood, New Jersey, where you have religious growing people, it's really not so true about them. Not always. I'm not saying everyone's perfect in Lakewood. But the experience I had as a used car salesman in Lakewood was actually he was very clear about the vision. And actually is a better seller at the end of the day, if you're honest. But it doesn't have to be a lot.
Still have a car.
No. No, but you are absolutely correct. And as Rabbi Schwab points out, it's a much broader discussion. I think you do have a story when you were living in Israel with a fellow in the store who gave you an introduction and said, "I'm here to sell you the product."
Yeah, this is one of these highly religious businessmen. He told me, I was negotiating a deal with him, and he says, "I want to tell you right up front, I said in English, "Ich bin a businessman. My motor is to make money." He says, I'm a businessman, and my goal is to make money. You have to know that when you're talking to me, okay? Now we can talk."
I'm not saying you have to do that, but that's yes.
You don't have necessarily.
Well, okay. For the record, in the insurance world, no one has ever complained ever about an insurance salesman or their tactics in any way. So that does not apply to this business that we're discussing.
Okay, now, in terms of what Adam brought up, that if you withheld information, and that would make a difference in the price of the premium, so that brings us to source number 5. And that is the idea of what's called in Talmudic language, mekachtos. Mekachtos means an erroneous purchase, an erroneous deal. And the case which is discussed in the Mishnah in Bava Basra, if you look at source number 5, is if he sold him superior wheat, meaning that's what they agreed. I'm going to sell you superior wheat. And he was found to be inferior, the buyer may retract. Inferior, if the deal was that the seller was going to sell inferior wheat, and it was found to be superior, not deliberately, by mistake, that's what ended up. The seller may retract. Wine, and it was found to be vinegar, and it was found to be wine, either one may retract. Now you'll note the distinction between the two cases. When I'm selling you superior wheat, let's just say, and you are you end up with inferior wheat or vice versa, so then only the wronged party may renege on the deal. If I was supposed to get from you better, higher quality wheat, and it turns out to be inferior quality, I'm allowed to renege. You, the seller, cannot renege. On the flip side, if it was supposed to be inferior, it turns out to be superior. Only the seller can back out, not the buyer. But if I was supposed to get wine and I got vinegar, or I was supposed to get vinegar and I got wine, either side may renege on the deal. Now, what's the difference between these two cases? Just briefly. Again, this is a very broad discussion, but just briefly for our purposes. The difference is as follows. When I purchased wheat, we agreed on wheat. I got wheat. The question is not so much whether I got the product that we agreed on, it's the quality of the product. And so when the quality of the product is in question, then only the wrong side has a right to renege on the deal, to back out and to undo the whole purchase. Because essentially I was supposed to get wheat, I got wheat. So the purchase stands, but the wrong side has the right to back out of the deal because he didn't get the quality he was supposed to get, or he didn't sell the quality he thought he was selling. But in the case where I was supposed to sell you wine and you got vinegar, I never want the vinegar. It's, as they say in English, apples and oranges. So apples and oranges, I don't want oranges, I wanted apples. In that case, either side, even if, let's just say I was supposed to get apples, I got oranges, oranges cost twice as much as apples. Okay? And so I got oranges instead of apples, and I'm getting something which is worth twice as much, I could still back out because I didn't contract with you to get oranges. I was supposed to get apples, and so the deal is essentially null and void. It's null and void. Neither side really has to take any action and say, I'm backing out. The deal is automatically null and void. Okay? And this has major ramifications depending on the nature of the erroneous purchase. If it's a totally different product, if it's apples and oranges, then the whole deal is null and void. Either side can back out at any point. Whereas if it's apples and apples, just a question of green apples and red apples, bad apples and good apples, where I got what I was supposed to get just of a different quality or nature, there you need an active, only one party can back out, and you need that party to actively pull out of the deal, otherwise the deal stands. Now how does that apply to our discussion? Well, let's talk about where I applied for a life insurance policy. And they asked me, how much do you weigh? And I wrote, I weigh 150 pounds. Okay? I weighed 150 pounds, I think, when I was like 10 years old. The last time I saw that number on the scale. So, if I put one foot on. So, if I were to write 150 pounds, they say, okay, he's 5'9", 150 pounds, he's very healthy, and they give me probably the best rate. This I can honestly say, I never smoked. Everything is good to go. So now they find out that in fact I weigh just a wee bit more than 150 pounds. I'm not telling you how much today, but it is right after Sukkot, so after the holidays. So now you can say the argument: well, that's a mekach toz, right? That's an erroneous deal. We thought we're issuing a policy on a guy who weighs 150, but you don't weigh 150. You weigh a lot more than that. So the whole deal is off. The question becomes now, is the deal automatically null, void, dead, or do they have to actually back out of the deal? The difference would be, let's say the company finds out about it, the company decides to ignore it, overlook it, and the fellow drops dead a week later. Could they say, well, it was a mega toss, so the whole deal was null and void, or not? Can they do that? So in almost all cases, you can't say this is apples and oranges. Because it's not like I'm taking out a life insurance policy on a human being and it turned out to be an elephant. No, I mean, even if you weigh quite a bit, but that's not the issue over here. It's I'm taking out a life insurance policy on a person, and it's a person. Some of the details, the quality may have changed. And so if the insurance company found out about it and ignored it and continued with the policy, so then they effectively failed. They knew about it. They failed to back out of the deal. And their failure to back out of the deal once they knew about it effectively leaves the deal in place. It leaves the deal in place, and they would have to pay up.
So I say I weigh 150 pounds, and the insurance goes through, and I die, and they find out I weigh 250 pounds.
Right.
2 years, you have no problem. 2 years.
Wait a couple of years, and you're all right.
Do you want to expand on that?
So they can back out because it's less than 2 years?
Yes.
They can not pay the claim.
Yeah, there's
less than 2 years, they can contest it.
Yeah.
Got it.
Do you want to expand on that? Right.
So, and what he's bringing up is within 2 years, we can contest all different parts of the contract, which is why when I'm discussing life insurance with folks and we deliver a policy, we say, just don't kill yourself for 2 years. And so in that case, sure, if they investigate it and find out and they decide that they wouldn't have issued the policy, they could rescind or back out, as you've discussed.
So what about an adjustment, for example? In other words, you find out after the person died, they were really 250 pounds. Is there some leeway to not pay out the full $1 million?
No. I mean,
it's yes or no.
Higher premium for those.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, not on that kind of policy. Not really.
They'd rather say no.
They would return all premiums paid.
Yeah, and if it's a case where it's rescission, where they say, you know what, we are not even on this anymore. There was not a contract, and they pull back. They'll return all the premiums paid for sure. But if someone's gone on, they're going to pay that claim or not.
So what if I'm 150 when I buy it? Sorry, one second. And over the 2 years, I get to be 250 pounds.
You're great. You can start. Yeah, once you get the policy, you can start smoking, base jumping, anything you want to do.
A little different situation. Maybe less than 2 weeks ago, a person was found guilty of killing his wife, and he had a $4.5 million policy on her, if I have it right. And then they're looking back previously, and a previous wife also died under
suspicious,
like a car fell on her. Let's go back to the first one. Let's just assume that he did collect on the first wife. Would the insurance company have a recourse to get the money back?
So, in those cases, first, I mean, depending on the years, there's going to be some kind of statute of limitations involved there. But also, if correct me if I'm wrong on this, but if the person whose life that policy was taken out on isn't involved in any kind of fraud, that money may very well still flow somewhere, just not to murdering husband. Meaning it doesn't mean just because he took it out with the intent to kill her and collect those funds, the policy, if the policy was properly issued, those monies are going to be paid, just probably not to him. It could go into an estate or to someone else.
The more recent one, I don't know, you know, where there was a $4.5 million policy for sure that was noted. That's what kind of the insurance company may have initiated.
I mean, if there are some suspicious circumstances, there that kind of money that might cause an investigation.
It's a motive.
It's what?
A motive. I mean, that's.
Yeah.
When somebody dies a violent death, one of the first things the police look at is, what's their life insurance? Who benefited from this death?
Sure.
So
sure. And even in the application process, some of the questions deal with the financial situation of the people involved.
Right.
And it goes to that exact motive reason. Why are you taking out such a big policy? You make, you know, $10,000 a year and have no kids. Mm-hmm. You don't need a $2 million policy.
One more example. A woman 2-3 years ago met a man on a dating site, something like that, and they went down to the Caribbean, but he took out a $100,000 policy on her, and if she agreed to it, she would have to, and she then disappeared. I think the reason it got so much notoriety is it had to do more with there was a young girl on a trip that was murdered, and the guy from Holland who's now in jail, and I've got all these stories.
All right.
And Chile murdered another person. But the one I'm thinking of is this guy that went on a date to the...
So again, if the policy is properly issued, the money's probably going to go somewhere. But if he's involved in wrongdoing in her death, it's probably not going to go to him.
Well, but they couldn't prove it, and there's no body. And
so that's probably a question for the investigators, then, not the insurance company. All right. So just one other point about this issue of the erroneous purchase, and that is Adam mentioned that the company may have a different recourse, not to void the policy, but to collect retroactively on the increase in the premium. I do believe that from a Torah standpoint, that would not be a valid recourse, because you have two options, either as the seller or as the buyer. Either you leave the sale in place, or you void it. So you wouldn't necessarily have the recourse to collect the difference. There's another area of halacha called onah, which is overcharging, where you're charging too much or too little, not because of erroneous information, because it's an erroneous purchase, because I wanted A and I got B, but just due to the fact that I charged you too much money for something. There's recourse potentially to collect the difference. But in a situation where you thought you were getting A and you got A 0.1, or you got B, either you void the sale, or you don't. It's one of those two. If both parties agree to pay the difference, obviously they can agree to whatever they want. But from a strictly, in terms of what the options are for the issuer, in terms of whether they can collect the money, the difference in the premium, from a strictly Torah standpoint, they wouldn't have that option.
They probably wouldn't have that option in insurance if it wasn't contained in the contract.
Correct.
So I assume there's nothing halachically impermissible about having a contract.
Right.
And says if the apples turn out to be primary, more green than red, you get a 10% rebate.
Absolutely. Yeah, thank you for bringing up that point. Let me add one point to that. Danny's pointing out that obviously if it's in the contract, that becomes part of the deal. And that's all good and fine. The other point is also we have an idea that even with Torah law, we have what's called Dina de Malchus Adina, the law of the land is law. And so if there are laws in place, just as an example, Anna mentioned that if a person made a fraudulent claim, they may in some cases have the right to deny the entire claim. From a strictly Torah standpoint, if I go ahead and make a claim for $1,000 and in fact it's $500, you can't deny the entire $1,000 just because I tried to pull a fast one on you. But if the law says, or it's in the contract, that a fraudulent claim may result in you waiving your rights to collect even a penny, so then that holds force and that holds force and that's it. So that would override the basic Torah laws of jurisprudence in that case.
I have a quick question back on the kegs of wine versus vinegar.
Yeah.
I'm probably reading too much into it, but when I initially read it, I thought he thought he was getting wine, but it was so bad it was like vinegar. It doesn't mean that, does
no.
it? It just means two different.
It could be the wine. If the wine would have spoiled and become vinegar, but that is a different item now. It's not wine anymore, it's vinegar.
No, I just thought it could be bad wine is what I'm saying.
No, if it's bad wine, as long as it's still categorized as wine, you may get into a fight over where you draw the line of what's wine and what's vinegar. But that's...
That's why I was asking.
Yeah. Okay, so moving along here, going over, because we are running out of time, so I just want to try to cover a couple more very relevant issues. One case which Adam discussed is where the agent is put to task to give advice, quote unquote, and so on, where he wants to obviously to get the best for his client. And let me just give a quick scenario over here. Let's just say I called up, as he said, I call up and I say, I drove into a pole in the King Supers parking lot. And actually, I'll say a story that actually happened with me. True story. I once loaded some furniture into the back of my Toyota Sienna, and it was a little precarious and sticking out a bit, and I said, well, whenever I slam the door, it always just pushes it right in, so I'll do that. And that's what I did. And went right through the window. true story. Besides earning many accolades for being a world-class klutz, which I have won many accolades over the years for that, so then I called up my agent, and I said, here's the story. And he said, the insurance policy covers it regardless. it's a no fault, and Safe Light came down and replaced the back window. But let's say Safe Light would only, let's say the insurance company would only cover it if I was not at fault, or the rates would go up because I was at fault, and I'm throwing furniture into the back of my car and so on. Would he be allowed then to go ahead and, let's say, to give me advice to do that, knowing that, you know, it's not his problem, it's my problem. I'm the one who's gonna say the lie. Or can he go ahead and take care of it for me? Obviously, I think the obvious answer is he's not allowed to do that. Can't lie, can't tell me to lie. But there's actually a law in the Torah about this, and let me take this in two steps. Let's say I went ahead and I filed a claim. I filed a claim, and I collected the money, and I wasn't supposed to collect the money. I lied on the claim, and I wasn't supposed to collect the money at all. But he gave me a piece of advice, or I on my own, and I lied. What happens now to that money? I collected the money. What's the law? Well, if the policy was such that I wasn't entitled to collect the money, I'm a thief. So if I wasn't allowed to collect the money, I'm a thief. I'm obligated to return the money to the insurance company. Let's say I was entitled to collect the money, but my premiums will go up. So then really, we're not talking about, I'm not an outright thief, I was allowed to collect the money, but now we just circle back to withholding information on your application. It'll circle back to that. Essentially, what I'm doing is, I'm withholding information that will make a difference in the cost of my application, in the cost of my premium. And so I'm not a thief for collecting the money on the claim, but I am guilty of Geneva's Das, of stealing their mind. Potentially, there's an issue of Mekach Tosna of erroneous purchase, because they're issuing the policy at the next juncture, every 6 months or every year, when it renews, based on false premises, so they potentially run back into that. So depending on the scenario, you run into different issues. Certainly to lie in the first place is forbidden. His responsibility, if he gives me that advice, he's not a thief, he's not really guilty of Geneva's Das, because he didn't say anything to the company, but he would be guilty of another prohibition, that is the prohibition of giving bad advice. You're not allowed to give bad advice. And so by him telling me, I think you should go ahead and lie to the company and you'll get the money, that would be a prohibition of lifnei iver l'asita michshol, thou shalt not put a stumbling block before the blind. And that prohibition encompasses giving someone bad advice. Giving someone advice to lie on their insurance claim, I think, is not such good. Well, we might disagree on that. But at the end of the day, it's not good advice. By the same token, if he goes ahead to the insurance company and tells them, let's just say, as an agent, he falsifies the information. Or if the adjuster inflates the claim on behalf of the client, so then he's guilty of giving bad advice to the company. Because the company is saying, we want to hear from you, your opinion on this matter. How much is this claim worth? So if you're deliberately falsifying the information, besides lying and besides Geneva's Das, you're in a sense giving them bad counsel. They're hiring you, they're paying you, even if they're not paying you, if they're just asking for your opinion, but they're expected to hear good, sound, reasonable information over here, and by you giving them information which is less than that, you're guilty of giving bad advice. So you would run into that issue as well.
That means every time you lie, you have a favor.
It depends if the person's acting on the advice.
Well, does the stumbling block issue exist if the person does act on it, but like it's you, you're not blind, meaning you know it's bad advice?
I would say, I would say even if you know it's bad advice, but the fact that you're advising as a counselor saying if you want to get your money.
You're professional, because you're professional,
right, I think so.
And you're giving that advice within that context, it makes it more of a, you know,
well, they admit that they may not know. They may not know how to do the shtick before you let them in.
Okay. So they're asking you for the advice.
There are different levels of this prohibition. The biblical one is when, you know, when they wouldn't be able to get to it without you. And then the lower level of rabbinical prohibition is when they could do it on their own. They could figure it out a different way, but you're just assisting them.
It doesn't have to be so deliberate on behalf of the agent either. I mean, it could be, you could have said, oh, it's too bad that you hit the pole in the parking lot, because if somebody had hit you, it would have been your fault. You know, and then they act on it. I mean, that's not necessary. Just say, go ahead and do it. Right?
That's true.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know if that's considered bad counsel.
Right.
Unless it's like wink, wink, wink. If what a pity.
No, but I think what you're saying is if the person says that honestly, just oh,
right,
meaning not in a wink, wink.
Are all black and white.
Correct. If the agent is just saying it as a matter of fact, not as advice, then it's not a problem. If he's saying it with, you know, a hefty wink, implicit, that's more of a problem.
All right, so I have one question. All right, and this is, it creates a little bit of gray area. But, you know, God forbid you're in a position where you have a claim, they're not always so clean cut. The adjuster comes out, he is coming out with a clear goal to pay the least amount of money, with a clear goal of minimizing the losses of the company, whereas I, on the other side, are trying to make sure I've got everything covered. And so you have this, you're dealing and negotiating with someone whose intent is to give you the least amount of money, and you have to convince him and point things out and take a stance on the other way, trying to raise the value up so that you actually get, you know, get full coverage. So it's, you're in a position where you're almost forced to exaggerate or to really be dogged on what you're trying to accomplish, because the guy on the other side is against you, right? You know, as a bargaining partner.
Right.
So
that could be actually a new negotiation from a Chosher Mishpat's side. Because now you would agree on the contract is that we're going to work this out. And so I don't know if it's a lie if Ken's saying, look, of course, he's not lying. He's being overly aggressive towards his position.
There is discussion in the Talmud about exaggerating with the intent of moving towards the middle. There is talk about that. It's a lengthier discussion, but there are cases where it's permitted. There's a verse which is often quoted by the Talmud that is, with a straight person you deal straight, and with a crooked person you deal crookedly. It doesn't permit you to steal from them outright or to grossly lie, but it does permit you some wiggle room in terms of using some degree of, I don't want to say deceit, but you know, cleverness in making sure that you get what you're entitled to. How much you're allowed to exaggerate, what situations are, is a case-by-case basis, and you have to seek competent rabbinical guidance. Just as an example, the Talmud talks about the classic case, if you've ever been to Israel, you go to the Shuk, and you say, how much is that? And the guy says, 50 shekels. 50 shekel crazy, it's not worth more than 5. And somewhere along the way, you'll end up at 25 or 30, whatever it is. And you sit and say, I'm not paying more than 5. But in your head, you're thinking, I'm going to pay 25 or 30. The Talmud talks about that, even where they go so far as to say, I swear I'm not going to pay more than this amount. I'm not advising talking that way. One should not make oaths just randomly or frivolously. The question is, does the oath now become binding, or is it understood that that's part of the negotiating process? So exactly how that applies and where it applies and how much you can bend the truth would depend on the situation. But certainly there is room for that.
Can I just, on Ken's question, can I ask Adam? Have you found that? I know that Dan was saying that nobody's smiling about paying, but I found that once the company is deciding that they're paying your claim, they're not going to nitpick with you. They're going to pay with you.
So I mean, so really, as a general rule, and the checks that the adjusters are writing are not coming out of their pocket, and. They want to, you know, what their mission is, take this for whatever it's worth, is to pay what a claim is worth. And so when you can look at it either pay the most we should pay and pay no more, or pay exactly what we should pay, whatever you look at it, you know, they're there to make sure that obviously the company's doing the right thing in paying the client, and at the same time do the right thing and don't get taken down a path where we're paying for a lot of things that we're not supposed to be paying for at the same time. So yeah, I mean, what I've found, at least luckily, I think with with the companies I'm familiar with, State Farm, Allstate, the bigger companies, as a general rule, take care of business. You know, they'd rather pay the right amount on a claim than go through the whole lawsuit thing and deal with all of that, because ultimately, that gets more expensive, and they lose plenty of customers that way. The business that we're in is paying claims. If claims didn't happen, the whole company would be out of business. So at some point, we got to pay claims.
Are we questions still? I've been bothered with the whole time.
Yeah.
Why is there an ability to check something? I think it's a rabbi question. And also, right? So then, my omission should not be, if I'm selling my body, A part of that is that they just send the guy down there to validate that weight, that blood pressure, that, you know, I'm not saying you can lie, but it's less, in my mind, it's less of a mental play. But they have the ability to check it out.
Even if they have the ability to check it out, and maybe Adam could add to this from a professional standpoint, but in the case of the car hood where there was previous damage, and they opt not to ask, not to check, and so on, and I know there was previous damage, and it makes a difference in the price, they really ought to be a deductible, and I'm not forthcoming with that information. Because if I know that they would want that information, and I withhold it, and they give me more money because of that, I'm essentially guilty of theft.
I don't think I'm guilty. I think I'm guilty of the nearest gas, but I'm not a car.
Because the fact that they have the ability, but in the contract it says, in the event that there's previous damage, there will be a deductible. So if that's what it says in the contract, or if that's standard with the contract, so then if I know that and I don't share it with them, I'm guilty of theft, even if they have the ability to check it. But I don't know what the contract says. If the contract says we will check and determine, maybe that changes it.
One of the first questions.
So they're going to ask.
Yeah, they're going to ask for sure, and they're going to look for it. For sure.
All right. Thank you, everyone. It's been a great one. We look forward to seeing you in 3 weeks on November 4th.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you.